You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Virginia has a long history of civil political discourse, which, if need be, can be repaired and restored. Part of that responsibility lies with the media, and part with the citizens who are consumers of that media. Bob Gibson came to the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia as executive director in March 2008. He is a 1972 graduate of the University of Virginia with a BA in Government and Foreign Affairs. After serving as news director of WCHV Radio, he joined the Daily Progress in August 1976 and has held a number of positions with the newspaper. He began his career covering police and local courts and has covered state and local politics and government. He was named city editor in 1982 and later special projects editor in 1992 when he wrote a series about racial disparities and justice in our local courts. In addition to his newspaper work, Bob has hosted a weekly political call-in show on WINA Radio in Charlottesville for 7 years. He has also hosted a public radio talk show since 2001 on WVTF-FM in Roanoke and Charlottesville. He has been a regular contributor and guest on public radio station WAMU's Kojo Namdi Show in Washington and often serves as a host of the evening edition on public radio WVTF. Mr. Gibson spoke at the November 10, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV member Bob McGrath.
Thank you. I'm Bob McGrath. I'm a proud member of Senior Statesmen of Virginia, and the officers asked me to be the moderator for today's program, and it's my pleasure to do so. We're fortunate to have Bob Gibson speak to us. This is not the first time he's spoken to senior statesmen, so he's familiar to many of you. Now, personally, it seems to me his topic today couldn't be more timely. This week, at least, we have a brief respite from the barrage of TV commercials, flyers, phone calls, whatever, that all seem to me, at least, to take absolutely the lowest of low roads in promoting whatever political candidates they're promoting. Now, Bob will answer the questions definitively. What happened to civility in politics, and what can we get it back? So we're looking forward to that. Mr. Gibson came to the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia as executive director in March of 2008. He is a graduate of the University of Virginia with a Bachelor of Arts in Government and in Foreign Affairs. After serving as news director of WCHV Radio, he joined the Daily Progress in 1976 and has held a number of positions with the newspaper. He began his career covering police and local courts and has covered state and local politics and government. He was named city editor in 1982 and later special projects editor in 1992 when he wrote a series about racial disparities and justice in local courts. And this led to Bob's being the winner of several Virginia Press Association awards, the 1993 Virginia Bar Association Award in the field of law and justice, and the 1993 Southern Journalism Award for investigative reporting about racial disparaging in sentencing. In addition to his newspaper work, Bob hosted a weekly political call-in show on WINA Radio in Charlottesville for many years. He's also hosted a public radio talk show since 2001 on WVTF-FM in Roanoke and Charlottesville. He's a regular contributor and guest on public radio station WAMU's Kojo Namdi's show in Washington, and often serves as host of Evening Edition on public radio WVTF. What a lot of acronyms here. Bob grew up in Arlington, Virginia. He's married to Sarah McConnell, who hosts the public radio program With Good Reason from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. So together, they keep us all apprised on all we need to know about government and public affairs. Let's welcome Bob Gibson.
Thank you all for having me back. It's good to be back. This is the kind of group that I like to talk with because, and not talk at, because A, you vote, and B, you're civil. Can we see a show of hands of people, not who are civil, but people who actually voted on Tuesday or before? This is most unusual. I spoke last night to a group of University of Virginia students, and while a good number of hands went up, it was nowhere near the percentage that just went up here. And that says a lot, because one of the disconnects in our politics today is the disconnect between people who vote in presidential elections and people who vote in other elections. And the 18 to 29-year-old voter, the one who doesn't pick up a newspaper because it gets, well, because they're not used to it, they read it on the Internet. Those people are more interested in national affairs. Luckily, this was a nationalized wave election. So if you were interested in national affairs, you could consider this your cup of tea. They just don't immerse themselves in the issues that voters who have been around longer and know what the issues mean to them immerse themselves in. So it's very good to see this group that not only votes and is civil but cares. And it's always good to be back and talk with you. I don't pretend to have a long discourse here today. I'd much rather engage in conversation with you. So what's happened to civility in politics, and can we get it back? Civility is not dead. It has just gone into hiding during a time of base elections. And that was alluded to by our last speaker. Base elections are base in many ways, not the least of which is that each side is playing to its base, trying to turn out its own base and trying to suppress the other side's base. To do this, they engage in the kind of advertising that is simplistic, twisted, nasty, mean, and generally can be said to be comparative if you're looking at it in a positive sense and negative if you're looking at it in a negative sense. American politicians largely play to their party's base today and are expected to. Or they are not rewarded. There's a tremendous example of that in Virginia on Tuesday of last week. Glenn Nye in the 2nd District was elected at the same time as freshman Tom Perriello, who won the closest election in the country 2 years ago by 727 votes. Glenn Nye decided that he was going to try to vote his district and separate himself and distance himself from his party base and from his president. He ended up losing by 18 points. And turning off his party base. The Democrats in Norfolk especially were not convinced that he was someone who was out there fighting for the same things that they believed in. He was tailoring his votes to something else, to perhaps stand a greater chance of being reelected. Tom Perriello, on the other hand, while he only voted 90% of the time by some measures with his party's leadership, on the key important votes, voted with his president and on the key issues that his party decided were important enough to move forward during the 2 years in which they had a large majority. That majority is gone. It's gone completely in the House of Representatives. But Tom Perriello was rewarded. Perriello was rewarded because people thought he stood for something, and they saw him as genuine. And they saw him as sticking up for his president, his party, his base, and the issues that he believed in. Even though you can make the case that a great number of people in the 5th Congressional District, which demographically is not Charlottesville and not Albemarle, a great number of people didn't find those views exactly comporting with their own. The 2010 elections, including the Perriello Hurt contest that ended in a 51-47 result 8 days ago, were totally nationalized. You know, usually in a midterm election, things like constituent service matter. Usually you're voting on a congressman or a congresswoman, not in Virginia, just a congressman, based on his or her record and his or her constituent service, with the latter being very important. A lot of that went out the window this time, as this election through the base wave became nationalized. By the time millions of dollars were spent in this race, and they were spent early, much earlier than in other districts around the country, because this was the closest takeaway that the Republicans suffered in 2008, Tom Perriello's name was Tom Pelosi Perriello, which is sort of double Italian and double liberal. Virginia has a long history of civil political discourse with long stretches of base incivility. But in national wave elections, we get national doses of incivility thrust upon our politics. Who was the number one spender during this last congressional election in the 5th District, which drew such good national attention? Was it Tom Perriello or was it Robert Hurt? It was neither. It was independent expenditure. That is a very troubling result for civility in our country. And the Congress is going to have to, at some point, step up and deal with the Citizens United case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in January, because we had more than $4 million poured into this district by 21 groups that decided that they were going to, for their own agendas, under their own names, which might not mean anything to the voter, and with undisclosed contributions in the millions of dollars, they were going to define who Tom Perriello was, Tom Pelosi Perriello, and they were going to define who Robert Hurt was. And the ads that came in against Robert Hurt were just as nasty, just as misleading. For example, the League of Conservation Voters Sierra Club ad, which Robert Hurt filed a lawsuit against and then dropped last week, charged that he voted for a study of uranium mining in Pennsylvania County, Virginia, his hometown of Chatham, to line his own pockets. Now, these environmental groups obviously disagreed with uranium mining, and that's a fair comparative ad. But they went a step farther, and they said, Tom Perriello was left out of this, but it's a good idea of the type of ad that was thrown against him as well as against Robert Hurt. They said Robert Hurt voted for uranium mining study to line his own pockets. I've known Robert Hurt for 10 years in the Virginia General Assembly. He is not known as the type of gentleman who is down there to line his own pockets. And yet that's the kind of advertising that gets twisted. As most of these national party and unparty and uncivil groups twist to make a point, they will take any small kernel of truth and hybridize it into their own version of reality and throw it at the other side in a very uncivil fashion. Virginia's politics are becoming much less distinctive and much more akin to our national politics. We saw this during this election. Several factors are constantly at work against civility. One is the 24-hour news cycle and the national cable media's obsession with finding and amplifying the loudest and most strident voices, sometimes the oddest voices. The news media is nationalized and is driven into or catering to partisan political camps to an extent that those of us who've been watching the news media for the last 50 years would not find recognizable. 4 years ago, there were four Virginia newspapers that had a bureau in Washington: the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Media General, the Roanoke Times, Virginian Pilot, the Newport News Daily Press among them, all had bureaus that would cover Washington based on what their own representatives in Congress, the two Virginia senators and their own representatives from their region, were doing in the nation's capital. Those four news bureaus are gone. They've all closed in the last 4 years. The reporting that was once done about your congressman in Washington isn't there to the extent that it was just 4 years ago. Our news media coverage of Washington is nationalized. It is no longer done by the local paper, and people are getting less and less of their news salient to congressional elections from their local paper. The political coverage of the Daily Progress, like every other daily that I know of across the country, has been diminished over the last 4 years because of cutbacks in the successful business plans of the newspapers, and this is true in radio and television as well. So the newspapers and the media outlets are tailoring their coverage to what the readers and viewers say they want. Well, the readers and viewers don't say they want news about state government, local government, and politics as much as they say they want news about other things. So you're getting what you're paying for, which is less, and you're getting what the polls tell the editors who make decisions about what's covered. In smaller doses, when I was writing for the Daily Progress, the average political story I could write would be 20 to 30 inches long. You're lucky if you see a 20 to 30 inch long story today, because reporters have more to do, more beats to cover, less time, and less space in the newspaper. Even the space in the newspaper has been shrinking as advertising revenue has been flowing outside the door to the internet. Newspapers could have been the Craigslists of their communities, but they were in the newspaper business. They didn't think about this new animal that was taking all their revenue until it was way, way too late. And now if you look at the websites of newspapers, they're not the friendliest. They're not the easiest to navigate. They're not the best sources of news in many places. We rely much more on other avenues, a disparate number of avenues for our news. And our news tends to be, I like to call it designer media today. Democrats and liberals and progressives tend to watch MSNBC and get more news from MSNBC. Republicans, conservatives, Tea Party folks love to watch Fox News. Why? In each case, they're less challenged by views and more comforted by views that comport with their own. And this kind of coverage is giving us the incivility that we see in our daily dose of political reality that, thank goodness, stopped last Tuesday when the airwaves stopped being bombarded with misleading comparative ads. The news media today is nationalized. It's driven into these catering, into these partisan camps. Political news is celebrity-driven, political news is personality-driven, and political news is entertainment-driven, because this is what viewers, readers say they want. One factor against civility, working against civility, is the permanent campaign. It used to be, back in the good old days, you all remember the good old days, that there was a time to campaign and have elections, and there was a time to govern and come together. Those times are a little blurred. A lot of the votes that are forced on elected representatives in their election offices are today set up for the next campaign. Each side is trying to catch a congressman or a legislator, or even in some cases local supervisors and city council members, on a vote that will be politically unpalatable in the next election. What this has done is it's not only brought us a permanent campaign, but it's brought us a cycle that is narrowed. And decisions are made based on the results that people think they can get in two-year increments, as opposed to looking down the road five or six or more years, which is the realistic road you would need to solve problems in many cases, to tackle big issues. If you've covered the Virginia General Assembly in any sense, if you've watched it, you know that you can't solve all the state's problems in 2 years. Virginia doesn't work that fast. It never has, and nor should it. The time cycle for accomplishing things is longer than a two-year cycle, yet the cycle in which politicians are rewarded or punished is a two-year or less cycle. So increasingly, the permanent campaign has taken over the ability to govern, and increasingly, the ability to compromise. And instead, we are given permanent campaigns that make political votes much more difficult. Electing political figures now, elected political figures are rewarded by their political base, for their staunch opposition to the other side, tearing down the other side, and standing up for principle and against compromise. Republicans are encouraged not to consort with, or have contact with, or talk with, or go out for a beer with Democrats, and vice versa. It's a sign of partisan weakness in Richmond now, where this didn't used to be true 10 years ago, but this has crept into our state government and politics from Washington as we have become nationalized. Hardcore Republicans have two ripe labels for moderate Republicans who work across the aisle. You all know one of them, RINOs, Republicans in name only. The other is, individually speaking, if you're referring to a moderate you wish to demean, you call him a squish. Democrats are no happier with their equally squishy moderates at times. The blue dogs now are a very endangered species and have been disappearing, well, this last week, in greater and greater numbers. Robert Hurt was a moderate Republican. You wouldn't know it from this campaign, would you? Who worked across the aisle. You wouldn't know that. He worked for a couple of dozen tax increases. Well, you would know that. You'd know that from the Republican Party primary, where there were five Tea Party folks among the seven vying for the Republican Party nomination. And they reminded voters quite often that, my goodness, he'd voted for tax increases. But he mended his rhetoric, and for this campaign, mended his fences on the right very successfully, beat the five Tea Party hopefuls in his primary in June, and won appealing to his larger political base. One thing I learned covering the two individuals, and I've known Tom Perriello for more than 3 years and Robert for about 10, is that they are much, much better and finer individuals than any of the ads would ever let on. Listen to what Tom Davis said in the Washington Post last Wednesday about Tom Perriello. Everyone went the other way, and Perriello stood his ground. He was the exception, and that's why he gets everybody's begrudging admiration. He's got nothing to be ashamed of. He fought a good fight. He just was in the wrong fight. As for Perriello's future, Davis predicted the freshman congressman is hardly done in politics. In my opinion, he is still viable, Davis said. The sky's the limit for him. He's universally respected. If he wants to stay in politics, he's the kind of person you want in politics. He's principled. He's earnest. He's polite. He's all of those things. He can come to Fairfax, and he'll probably win forever. Now, that says a great deal about somebody who knows a great deal about politics. Tom Davis laying those words on Tom Perriello. Because Tom Davis was, when he was in the Congress of the U.S., in charge of the Republican National Congressional Committee, which went out and recruited candidates for office across the country and then raised the money to get them elected. So he knows what kind of Democrat and what kind of Republican will win what kind of district. And he's saying that basically civility will pay off, at least pay off in Fairfax. Now, I'm not sure that civility is dead only to Fairfax. Elsewhere outside of Fairfax. I think civility has taken a hit everywhere and is in hiding until it's allowed to come back out. Robert Hurt won a prominent piece of a big wave election that was a nationalized election, the biggest sweep since 1938 in a congressional midterm election, and a very, very expensive election marked by huge independent expenditures. Who voted here? You all did, and you're to be congratulated. Who didn't vote here? Well, Albemarle led the state in voter turnout. The 5th District led the state in voter turnout, 55% in the district, 65% or more in Albemarle County. The president's visit and the closing days of the campaign had something to do with that. It probably didn't help or hurt either candidate too terribly much, but it certainly increased the turnout in these two jurisdictions of Charlottesville and Albemarle, where they were higher than expected turnouts, especially in black and minority precincts, where there had been a noticeable lack of excitement about this election compared to 2 years ago. So does the president's visit portend the kind of politics that we're going to see over the next 2 years? I think it does. I think the president and the new Congress are going to put, at least temporarily, what happened on prior to Tuesday aside, and they're going to reach across the aisle. They're not going to expect the hand that's going to come across, but they're going to make the perfunctory offer of reaching across the aisle for cooperation on some of the major issues that can only be solved if the two parties actually sit down and talk with each other and agree to work together. This was proven unsuccessful in our national health care debate for many reasons. This proved unsuccessful in a number of other high-profile votes over the last 2 years, so I'm not at all optimistic that this newfound attempt at civility and bipartisanship will be a lasting thing. In fact, I would guess that there's probably about a 6 or 8 month window in which it could work, after which time each party will retreat into its base camp again. So I think the time to watch and the time to have a good influence on politics is the next 6 to 8 months, because I think in that 6 to 8 month period there is a real opportunity for both sides to accomplish something that they haven't been able to accomplish 2 years ago, which is to work on a compromise on a major issue. And if you're going to reform entitlements, that's the only way that it's going to work. Neither party has the ability any longer to dictate its way. Republicans who just won a massive landslide wave election by electing 60 to 68 new House members, there are about 8 contested seats still undecided in the House. 60 is the current net total switch to the Republicans at the moment. There will be an attempt to take that quote-unquote mandate and play to the base and make a case that we aren't going to lose our principles. We came here to do what you all sent us here to do, and we aren't going to compromise. But there will be people in that group of House Republicans who will understand the value, people like Tom Davis, people like Robert Hurt, who will understand the value of A, civility, and B, the chance that they can work across the aisle to accomplish at least some things between now and the time when that window closes and we get back into more permanent campaign. The permanent campaign isn't totally 2 years yet. It leaves a brief window at the beginning for bipartisan cooperation, and that doesn't come without civility. If you've been bashing someone for about 6 or 8 months on television, it's awfully difficult to get in the same room and compromise. You really need to understand that you're working with someone who has his own constituency, and that you have your own, and that they have things in common, and that those things can be negotiated or compromised for each. Part of the responsibility lies with party leaders, who must demand it and practice it if civility is to be restored. Part of it lies with the media, which must demand it and practice it. I'm not very optimistic. Part of it lies with citizens and voters, who must demand civility and practice it. Trust, civility, respect, and politics are part of the glue that allows us to work together and get things done. They come and they go in politics, which is cyclical. And our cyclical nature of our politics has, with the current media environment, compressed itself so that cycles happen much faster than they used to. We have seen tremendous change in recent elections, and given the 2-year increment to get something done to prove that that change was worthwhile, in an incivil atmosphere, there is not the time to do that. So the change becomes change in reaction to the other side. America is a melting pot of cultures and ideas and people who believe in a set of ideals we call the American dream. Disrespect and civility go hand in hand with people who want the American dream for themselves but would deny it to others. Civility is a value that says someone is worthy of respect, and everyone who wishes to has the right to pursue that American dream. Incivility says, I'm right, and you're not as worthy of respect. Politicians who practice incivility will invite people to respond in kind and to be bitten themselves by sharp tongues. Sugar and honey still are tastier to most people than vinegar. People learn from failure, however, more than they learn from victory. We have a short window in which to learn that civility has a place in breeding compromise. We have more in common than we realize, because our politics obviously is meant to emphasize our differences. Differences and competition can make a better product if people talk to each other and understand each other. So how can we improve our civility in politics? I don't have the answer, but that's something I'd like to talk to you about. So let's start a conversation. And let me ask you for an idea of how we can improve civility in our politics. There's a microphone that will be coming forward, and you'll get the first crack at being civil and trying to solve our civility problem. Right here, in the middle.
I'm very upset with politicians in general. You're saying there that some of them have civil ways of dealing with situations. I hope that's true. But the point is, people who gain power then should stand up and tell the rest of their base that they won't accept that kind of situations where people are not civil to each other. It seems to me that what's happened is adults have become children. They don't know how to carry on a intelligent discussion.
And so that's you would what encourage political leaders to be the ones...
Absolutely. The people who now are in power have the responsibility of being moral and showing the rest of us that they won't stand for the people who, behind them who are trying to win an election, and they'll do anything to do that. When you have somebody in Congress who will throw a remark at the President of the United States by saying he can shove it, and we know what he's referring to, how he refers to that, the same way that someone threw a shoe at President Bush. I mean, what kind of country are we that will accept that? And until our leaders are moral, how can the public expect justice of any kind?
It is very difficult when you've been inciting your base to get out and thump the other side.
Doesn't matter.
To then tell your base, oh, and today it's over, let's be civil. You have to show civility in your political rhetoric before the election for anyone to listen to you with any credibility after the election. And I think our leaders on both sides acknowledge that they have fallen down in that respect. I personally blame as much the media and as much political consultants, because it's the consultants who very easily craft these political bombs that are thrown in 30-second doses at the other side, because they know they'll work. And the consultants don't have to come home and live in that district. The candidate does. And the candidate wants to win enough that he gives in to the advice of consultants who say, this is what you have to do to get elected. And they throw brickbats that are perhaps less than truthful, certainly twisted, to make those wonderful comparisons that give us our voters most of their information. So you're right. I mean, political leaders have to be the ones to step up, and they aren't always doing it. Yes.
I see another role outside of the political leadership. One of the bases for civility would be to have a common ground of practical, factual truth. Because the influence of money, the influence of the prospect of loss if the truth were known, the manipulation of emotions has created an environment where there is no third party to whom you can turn and get practical, factual truth.
The media used to play that role.
I know. If you go back long enough, you have the Fairness Doctrine, and the media excluded itself from the partisan rhetoric. it was legally required not to do that. They would have to present an opposing view. But when you're looking for the truth, you don't necessarily find it by giving a platform to one advocate versus another advocate in an adversarial confrontation.
Very true.
You need to have someone somewhere in the media or someplace where people can say, this information is reliable. This is the information.
We have fact checks and ad checks and groups that do fact checks and ad checks. And frankly, they don't have the $100 million behind them that the false or misleading or twisted facts have behind them.
I mean, there's huge profits at stake on the determination of actual fact. But if somewhere we could find someone in the media or some institution that could provide at the front line, not in a reactionary way, not responding an hour or two or 10 or 12 after the statement is made, but be a reliable source of practical, factual truth, then the dialogue could continue looking for practical solutions.
What you need most of all is an educated and informed electorate. And I think that is a very difficult thing for people to engineer in this designer media today. They have not found the neutral, reliable, objective voice that perhaps they once found. So I think we need a return in our media to a little bit more objectivity than we are seeing. And I don't think you're going to find that instant voice that with authority is going to be Walter Cronkite or going to be the person who comes on and says, this was true, this is the way it was. That day and that fairness doctrine and that media are gone. We need a new, believable set of sources of information that people can turn to and will turn to and will inform themselves. And right now, there are any number of startup nonprofit groups attempting to provide that voice. There are newspapers that are still trying to provide that voice. There are still media outlets trying to provide that voice. And it's very difficult for a consumer to find exactly the right blend of news that he or she is looking for and have trust in. The media are about as trusted as the congressman these days, and for good reason. I mean, we are guilty in my former profession of catering to the loudest and the oddest and the most personality and the most entertaining, and I'm not a witch, and I'm not a witch, by the way. Yes.
Could you comment just a little bit about the fact that there was a terrific swing, you mentioned, since 38, about a couple things, one being the quite big increase in the number of independents as opposed to Republicans and Democrats, and then that impact on throw the bums out, i.e., is this one of the greater changes by virtue of disappearance of incumbents historically?
This is one of the greater ones. It's the largest since 1938, and I think the reason is the economy. I think Americans in a bad economy have less patience and less trust in their government. When it can't fix something in 2 years, it is seen as failing. And a great deal of what troubles us can't be fixed in 2 years. It requires more effort than that. It requires more than one party's participation. One party was rewarded this time for saying no. Well, there's only a certain number of times that you can be rewarded for saying no. Eventually, you have to say yes to something. And I think we're going to see a real test of the Republican Party knows that it has the ability to do what it says it wants to do in terms of reforming our economic decline in terms of the amount of money that we're spending that we aren't putting into the economy. I think we need an economic fix that is going to take two parties to bring about. And the president has indicated a willingness to step across and shake hands and talk at the White House. Republican leaders have indicated they will go to the White House. I just think that we're going to see another wave, and it may be in the other direction, if this fails and the president is then allowed to be Harry Truman and run against the do-nothing Congress. Terry McAuliffe, who is a candidate for governor again in Virginia, told our Sorensen classes this summer, the best thing that can happen to President Obama is to lose the House of Representatives. And the kids all said, what? What are you talking about? And he said, President Obama will be reelected if he loses the House of Representatives and has someone to run against, because he can't run against his own party, which was stifling him in the efforts to gain compromise on various measures that needed compromise during the last 2 years. So, Terry McAuliffe had a good point. The president's in a much better position to win reelection today, and he's in a better position to offer a hand and a civil tone to the next 6 months. And he said he will. Now, Republican leaders, I have some confidence that they will start to and try to do that. I have some confidence that their base will not allow them to do that. Already, Robert Hurd is getting messages from supporters throughout the 5th Congressional District, we are going to hold you to your principles. Well, holding one's to one's principles can mean no compromise. It can mean if you vote for one thing that we disagree with, we're coming after you again. So we live in a very tenuous time when it comes to the ability to be civil with each other, the ability to talk together and to understand each other, and to build on what is really a great common thread of agreement that most Americans have with each other. I mean, 80%, 70% of the health care plan is popular and was promulgated and pushed by Republicans until they found that saying no was a more productive way to get election.
Bob, I think it might be instructive to this group. When you were at the Daily Progress, you were the dean of the local reporters and had a background to draw on of what went before. At that time, what was your impression, or what would you say the tenure of most of the people on the reporting beat, be it newspaper, TV, or radio? How long had they been around? What body of knowledge did they carry with them?
That's a good question. It varied by market size. In the Richmond Times-Dispatch, which some of us still read, the average tenure of reporters was somewhere between 10 and 15 years. It's now between 3 and 5, I would guess. At the Daily Progress, the average tenure of reporters was somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5. It is now less than 1 or 2. Brian McNeil, who took my beat, is one of those 5-year vets. So he knows what's going on and has some political background and covered Virginia politics and government for the Connection newspapers in Northern Virginia before coming to Charlottesville 5 years ago. But that's the exception rather than the rule. The average reporter is at a smaller paper like the Daily Progress, which is now under 30,000 circulation, is going to have folks who are 2 to 3 years out of college and maybe a couple of years on the job as reporters. So they don't have the same depth of contacts and context that someone who's been there longer have. That's why papers like the Washington Post and the Richmond Times-Dispatch, which used to have the tenure guaranteed if you wanted to continue in a job, it's like teacher tenure. That's a little imperiled these days, too. But reporter tenure is gone. It is out the window in buyouts and in layoffs and in floundering by the corporations that own the papers in an attempt to find a workable business model. Yes.
Bob, out of curiosity, how much of the $4 million that came in from outside sources went to the Perriello camp versus the Hurd camp? And do you know yet roughly how much was spent, excluding this amount, by the Perriello and Hurd camps?
I know the Perriello camp spent $3.7 million. That is less than the $4.1 million that independent groups combined, for the 21 largest of them, spent through the early part of October. So that figure will go up. I don't know what the final figure will be, and I don't know what the breakdown is. I asked the campaigns that question, And the Hurt campaign said that most of the ads, independent ads, especially coming in late, were Perriello. The Perriello campaign said most of them were stacked against them. I haven't seen any good hard figures. I did get a figure from the campaign manager of the Hurt campaign yesterday evening that said of the ad buys, 3.9 million in ad buys were pro-Perriello or anti-Hurt, and 3.1 million were pro-Hurt or anti-Perriello, which speaks to what largely happened, which was each side had a strong enough candidate and a strong enough base of support that the parties poured in tons of money and the independent groups poured in larger tons of money, and we ended up with a barrage of ads that probably canceled each other out for the average consumer who had to watch. They were kind of sad. Yes?
Oh, I got to ask a question.
Is this on?
Yeah. So you kind of touched on this before, but let me call it the professionalization of politics. With the kind of money that's floating around now, everybody, even if they're a well-intentioned, wanting to be civil candidate, ends up in the clutches of political handlers and so forth, and they're paid to win, and they use political psychology studies and all sorts of things. Almost none of it is directly related to sort of educating the voter, right?
Well, it's loosely related to that.
Loosely related. But if you could imagine a hypothetical world, where you just sort of, I read in the paper the other day that in this last election that on average we spent about $50 a voter. And most of that money, I think, was for counter, ads that countered one another, and
right.
You walked away not learning much. If you could roll that number back so that there just wasn't that kind of money sloshing around to fund political campaigns, do you think we'd automatically get more civility?
I think we'd get more civility if we went back to the Jeffersonian, Madisonian model, which was quite uncivil in its day, but involved, since you mentioned sloshing around, giving booze to the electorate rather than ads. The problem I have with the professional campaigners is that the consultants are really very good at their craft, and they have no morals. There is no value given to civility. There is great value given to incivility in the advertising realm of political campaigns today. And it's very difficult, once you spend as much money as they spend, to have another message either by the candidate or right after the election, regardless of who wins, because you've just spent, in the case of this election, $7 million trashing the other side. Well, you can't turn around and say, oh, and let's be civil today. I'm going to reach out. It doesn't work quite that well. The professional campaigns of today are run by folks who are slash-and-burn artists who don't live in the districts in which they practice their craft, and who aren't responsible and aren't held responsible. There's such a low level of professional tolerance. There's crossing the line. Crossing the line is rewarded rather than punished in our political campaign atmosphere today. And it's rewarded because each base expects its side. I spent 2 months arranging a debate between Tom Perriello and Robert Hurt. It was very difficult to arrange the debate because we had an independent third-party candidate who wanted to be included, and one candidate wouldn't appear on stage with him if he was included, and the other candidate wanted him included. And let's just say it took a long time to get to an agreement, and we lowered the threshold from the League of Women Voters, 15% for an independent to qualify, to 10%, and still were nearly sued by Mr. Clark because he was on the ballot but never really got above 5% or 6%, I think, was his highest polling number. He finished with 2.1%. He started with 2%. So I think it was fair for us, and the media colleagues I had in this debate only wanted two candidates on stage, and they wanted the two major party candidates. I wanted the two major party candidates on stage. I was willing to get Mr. Clark if we could, but we couldn't. So it's very hard to arrange something for an electorate that offers more than these 30-second biting ads. There were about six of these debates, about two of them televised where the average person in Charlottesville could watch them. And they were a little bit more instructive than the 30-second ads, but they were cheering sections. And my job as moderator was to make sure they weren't jeering sections during these debates. I couldn't stop the cheering, but luckily, with plenty of off-camera appeals to the 550 people we had in the hall in Danville, we kept the jeering out. So we ended up with a full hour of candidates talking about real issues with applause taking away from their time. But those audiences, there wasn't a neutral person in the hall that I saw. Those audiences would have cheered had one side played 30 minutes of their campaign commercials and the other side played 30 minutes of their campaign commercials. And that's what the average voter saw. The average voter didn't see the debate. The average voter didn't see anything more than this guy's middle name is Pelosi, or this guy's middle name is line his own pockets. The professional state of the media and the professional state of our campaigns these days are two of the factors that will keep us from being civil, and we have to do something about both. And there are plenty of good people in the media, and there are plenty of good people in campaigns who would like to, but that's not the business model that's working. Yes.
I think you started out where I would begin by saying, how do people develop this opinion that this is truth and they don't have truth? You know, if you're Republican, you go to one TV. If you're a Democrat, you go to another. If you're an independent, Lord knows where. I don't think anybody here wasn't offended by this campaign, but every day, all day long, on the radio, flip it on, and what you get is in paranoia.
Yes.
Enemies.
Yes.
Destruction, subversion. Every single one that I listen to, whether they're locals or national people, their ratings are how many people are going to listen.
It's a working business
model. And they excite the people to listen and call into their show with all kinds of paranoia. And, you know, this is going on 360 days a year.
It speaks to how much voting is emotional.
It is.
You don't see your average voter sitting down with three newspapers and going, well, I agree with this guy on this issue, and I really like this guy on this issue, and, you know, I'm going to weigh this against this and come out with a rational model for who I should support in this election. That's not the way it works.
When I was in college, I used to read a skinny paper from England on a counterpoint of view of things, just so I'd find out how other people looked at us. And I don't see it in decades at University of Virginia that you have very many students who could care less, as long as they're still there.
Well, if you're asking for a model, I would say that the best model is to find as many news sources of information as you can find, mostly on the internet these days. But there's still some that you can get delivered to your door that are worth reading, and to vary and broaden your reading materials so that you understand more than just one side and more than just one narrow base. And that way, Americans, you know, my children, I have three daughters, they get their political news from Comedy Central, from Jon Stewart. Now, that's a very entertaining model, but it's not exactly where you expect to get the unvarnished, total, objective truth. You're getting a version of the truth, and that's true on all the... watch both sides. I mean, watch both sides and go for the middle. I think National Public Radio still does a tremendous job of covering issues. Do they have a slant? Probably, by what they choose to cover, but they try to be fair. You know, it's funny with the three cable networks that provide the most news, Fox News in first place, MSNBC in second, CNN in third, the one that tried to go down the middle was CNN. I'm not saying they succeeded, but they certainly lost audience trying. And the other two were rewarded.
So they're number three.
Yeah, yeah. And they had a CNN headline short news channel that completely lost out and is now talking heads because the model was not sustainable for short news, unbiased, you know, the way the BBC tries to do it. Yes?
Hypothetically, what would it take to have a watchdog organization that's issues-oriented, like Common Cause used to be, coupled with publishing those facts on a national basis so that we could get facts? I don't know that we're ever going to cure what ails us at this point without something to override. And I can't imagine anything other than a third organization. I'm not calling it a political party, but an organization that speaks to what you alluded to before that can report the facts. Well, what would it take to have that happen?
It would have to be nonpartisan. It would have to be seen as being fair and nonpartisan. It would probably have to be nonprofit, and it would have to rely on the kindness of strangers. It would have to rely on donations from individuals who believe in the kind of product that it would be putting out. And I think we're seeing a number of these start up in the last 5 years. You know, Charlottesville Daily Progress has this partner in Charlottesville Tomorrow, the website. Charlottesville Tomorrow, if you go to the website and you want to pick out an issue and go and see how it was handled at the County Board of Supervisors or the County Planning Commission or the school board, you can do that, and they will give you down to the minute where that issue was discussed, and you can get the complete on-the-record discussion. You do get facts. Now, you also get a presentation based on, you know, what they're interested in, which is growth issues and water issues, and that's very important stuff that needs to be covered. Charlottesville's newspaper, the daily newspaper, lost the ability to cover all those meetings, and we're blessed with the fact that at least we have a nonprofit that is willing to send cameras and recording devices to these meetings so that, you know, the citizenry, as it cares to, can inform itself. I think the nonprofit model is going to start to thrive on the national level. It's going to replace the investigative reporting teams that have been chopped from our major newspapers and our major networks, and they are going to offer themselves as partners, and have already started offering themselves as partners to the major media outlets. And they will present the kind of reporting that I think will be fact-based and as reliable and nonpartisan as we can find. These are really in the startup phase right now, and they're coming more and more online with major media partners, and I think we have to look there to find that objectivity in reporting that people can trust. And they have to be as far away from the political parties as they can be, and as far away from the political donors, and yet they will be characterized as one side or the other, and sometimes fairly. Yes.
First of all, as an aside, I want to say that these meetings are covered by Charlottesville Podcasting.
Which is great.
And so you can get this and other meetings of different organizations through that venue.
I think that's a good venue, and I go there often.
And my question is, what you mentioned when you were talking about the influence of the national monies coming in from all these different unknown organizations into our local situation, and that was because of the Supreme Court ruling.
Citizens United case in January.
And so what can we do to, I mean, that shocked a lot of people, so what can we do to overturn that or make that go away? Because that brought a lot of national media into this campaign, a lot of ugly things
Without the accountability of where the
exactly.
money was coming
they
from.
Didn't have the accountability. They didn't live in the district. They couldn't see their neighbors the next day.
Right.
So what can we do? Because the Supreme Court gave the law of the land.
I think, well, the Supreme Court did not close the door to disclosure. The Supreme Court left it up to Congress to open the door to disclosure. And I think what needs to happen in across the country is the kind of lobbying, citizens' lobbying effort that has produced reform in the past that says our system is corrupt without disclosure, or the potential for corrupt money in our politics is too great without disclosure. And we need to petition the Congress as reasonably as we can, as civilly as we can, and as forcefully as we can, to enact real, meaningful disclosure. Now, what happens with political campaign contribution law is that money flows downhill and always finds a way around whatever limits are set. So I think what we have in Virginia, without limits, is the cleanest form of system that is reasonable in our country today, given the First Amendment and given the fact that rich individuals are going to run and spend their own money and hopefully lose. We have full disclosure for every campaign donation over $100. And I think if we had that on the national level, and we didn't set all kinds of limits that money can find its way around, but we had full and accurate and true and instant disclosure, as we do have in Virginia. We have a wonderful system for disclosure that we will shine and disinfect in light upon something that right now has a great potential to lead to corruption in our politics. So I think it's very important that the Congress address this issue quickly before it gets completely out of hand and the corporate donations go hog wild from God knows where and Americans for Clean Living becomes the biggest donor to every campaign. Yes.
One of the things about incivility that bothers me the most is individual incivility on the part of the population. For example, we went to a Tea Party meeting just to see what it would be like, and there were people there who Tom Perriello was speaking, and they preceded their question with a big insult. I hate you, you're the worst congressman we've ever had, etc. That to me is individual incivility, and the leader of the Tea Party tried not, but several people there did that. Or the terrible attacks they made, individuals, and many of them people of our age. And on another occasion, I just tried to talk to them. You couldn't even talk to them without it getting into a serious argument. So what can be done about that? And perhaps it could be the churches, the schools.
That's what I came here to ask you all. Now, you're right. And our politics today and our political groups are even the parties themselves at times, reflect the people's feelings of incivility. Civility has not always been a high political standard or a high political value. It has been. We've been fortunate in our past in this state, I think, to have a relatively civil and a relatively clean political culture. I think that relatively civil and soon to be that relatively clean political culture is being challenged by what's happening at the national level. The only way I can see out of this morass is by individual accountability to hold ourselves and our elected representatives and our political parties and our media to the higher standard that we would like to see in our politics. And that means writing and supporting groups such as the Sorensen Institute, which teach civility in politics. What we do is we have four programs that get roughly equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans together each year. And they study issues together, and they study how the other side, they get to know each other. and they understand each other better than they would have, because we tend to hang around with our own. Most of our friends agree with us, and we agree with most of our friends. But when you get into a political leadership position and you meet people on the other side who are just as smart, just as engaged, just as engaging, and have views to share that enrich your own, because you're now understanding what the other side. We have folks who, years after going through the program, will call up a Republican friend from their class if they're a Democrat and say, "Now, how do Republicans really see this issue? You know, tell me why you believe this, and tell me, you know." It's that kind of understanding and talking to each other that's going to solve this, not the kind of yelling at each other that our media rewards and that our politics right now rewards.
I am a former educator. I think that we need to start with children, manners, proper dress, behavior, how to get along with each other. Sometimes in schools we have debating teams, you know, how to do it in a manner. You're saying what you want to say, but sometimes it's how we say it.
Yes.
I think the media has a lot to do with it, the movies on television, the fighting, the hitting, the, you know. I was in the doctor's office about a week ago. This lady came in. She was dressed like she was a nurse. She was so loud on her cell phone. That's not being civil. Couldn't she have, she could have stepped right out and have gone out and used
We've
the cell
phone. We've all been there.
You know, so it extends to every aspect in our lives, and it starts off to, we've got to start with kids. We're setting very poor examples. But right now the emphasis is on passing the test. You know, it's, you know, but what about manners and that kind of thing?
I agree completely. My wife and I, Sarah McConnell and I, take a course every semester at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education, in education. And the course that I just came to this group from today is called the Anthropology of Education. And it's fascinating. We study what education exists in other cultures and how much of it comes in school and how much of it comes outside of the school, and how education has changed over time to either replicate, reproduce, or otherwise change behavior and learning in a culture. And I think we have gotten to the point where our education system has gone from its roots, which is federal, which is rather state and local control, to the extent of federal control that basically says, all right, you guys fix these problems, and we're not going to give you the money you need to fix it. You come up with the money. And by the way, if you don't meet these standards, we're going to brand you something and take away your ability to do even that. So what would I do? I would start teaching civics and civility in kindergarten.
Bob, you brought up a few good points, and I want to ask about some of them and talk about some of them. One of them is the courts. The Supreme Court is a pretty civil group in itself.
Sometimes.
And yeah, but I mean, when they're talking, they obviously get times when they become inflamed about a particular issue that they're talking about. But basically, they're a balanced group in the sense of civility.
Yes.
And the way they work together. The other thing I think about is C-SPAN. C-SPAN has been an excellent program for giving a pretty balanced viewpoint on a number of issues on TV.
And I can tell you what the ratings are, too.
I know it. They're down at the bottom, I would think. The other thing is that we've got people. We think back in Jefferson's day, he was a pretty civil guy.
Except when he bought newspapers to trash his opponent.
And he had his problems with a newspaper man who railed him all the time. And he had his tough times. But he would go down the mountain on occasions to see a ministry taking place at the bottom of the hill, even though he was nowhere related to the way that ministry would be. He made sure that he found out about everything he could to make a good sense of things. The thing I'm concerned about today is we've got basically a sort of a bell curve type situation. We've got people at the top who are very civil, and we've got people at the bottom of the curve who are very uncivil. And I think we're going to always have that type of thing. The problem is going to be to somehow follow what you said and come up with an attempt to understand from different media sources, whether it's leaning to the left or to the right or the middle. Don't, even though you might be on one end or the other, you just can't give up the idea of trying to get as much information to figure out for yourself what your position would be. What I want to know is, how are the students, the young people in this country, going to do it when they have such a divided situation facing them every day in the music world, their studies, their professors? Maybe they'll pick up something out of all of this and make something out of it. We did, and it took me about 70 or 80 years, but it looks to me like it can be done.
Well, what I see in our two youth programs is very encouraging, because we run a high school leaders program every summer for 2 weeks at UVA and a college leaders program every summer for 4 weeks at UVA. And the individuals who come from around the state to participate in those programs have not only a very sharp sense of how politics should work, but a belief that it can work. And they learn, as sort of the nerds of their class, that they're not the only person in their school that believes as they do, and they're not the only person in their community who believes as they do, and they work together. And each program concludes with the class is divided into six groups, which propose legislation for the Virginia General Assembly on six various topics. And this year, we had professors and we had legislators judge the panels and give them a hard time as they gave them a grilling of how would you do this and what about this. And the legislators left the dome room of the rotunda with the packets that they had come to judge and said that they were worthy of introduction as legislation. I think the problem is not with our young people. The problem is with our culture and its low levels of expectations and its low levels of patience. We need more patience with people we don't understand and people we don't agree with. Right now we're willing to dismiss them as people that just don't understand and people who just aren't as educated as we are. And if we understood and took the time to listen to them and could listen to them, I think we'd find much more in common than our media or our politics or our culture tells us we have in common. I think programs that bring these people together are successful indicators that this can be done and is being done, and that we don't have a cause to be overly pessimistic about the future. We just have to get our system back on track so that people can talk to each other. And I think they will. I think they would. Yes.
My name is John Hall. When a falsehood is believed, it creates confusion in the mind of the listener. Confusion and false impression. I think that there's a lack of civility, mainly because of confusion and false impression. And I think part of that has to do with the media and the terminology they use a lot of times, and the confusion that results from terminology that's poor. A good example, I think 100 years from now, people will look back and they'll say, well, why did they say the word healthcare when they're talking about reform? Why don't they say the word medical care when they talk about reform? Because healthcare is an oxymoron, which is a stupid term, if you think about it, unless you're talking about insurance.
We do everything in shorthand. We do everything symbolically. And our shorthand and our symbology is less than helpful when it comes to common understanding. You're right. And we need to understand what we're talking about. No one understood the healthcare bill. I don't care if you were for it or against it. It was very easy to mischaracterize because no one understood it. And people still don't understand it. Even if 80% of it is popular, no one has a good picture of what the health care bill is. All we know is that it's going to take $500 million or $500 billion out of Medicare, and that's going to threaten our seniors.
Don't you think if we had a shorter campaign season, not an endless campaign season, that it would lead to more civility? They'd have to address the issues instead of the trash.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, how could we get them to go back to that? I remember when we had shorter campaign seasons.
I think people can demand a period of respite from campaigns, but they won't get it. There will always be a campaign at some level. We in Virginia are blessed with not only permanent campaigns, but a variety of quickly upon the electorate campaigns, so that there is no respite for even the politically involved or those who donate money to local candidates. We're blessed with a system that was created back in the late 1920s of separating federal elections from local and state elections. Well, that separation is gone. Candidates for local office now are asked about national and international issues because we do not have an understanding of what people's roles truly are in those elected offices. I think it goes back to teaching civics and civility. We need to understand what the limitations of our the limitations of campaigning and the limitations of true expectations. We expect more of our government than it's able to provide, and then when it doesn't provide it, we want to soundly thrash them.
I agree with what you say about culture being the problem. When you look at the entertainment industry and you see how much of that is violent, and violence is, I suppose, the ultimate in incivility. And I think that pervasive violence that we see throughout is a real negative towards any move towards civility.
Well, attacking Hollywood like you are, you must be Republican. No, I agree with you. We have a culture that is base and that is profited by being base. We also have a culture that is higher than that and that survives higher than that. We have every level of entertainment and cultural offering that you can possibly want, from wonderful opera to trashy world, whatever the wrestling is. I forget what it is. All I know is it comes on after my favorite show, which is NCIS. What do we do about our culture? We reward the parts of it that we think are worth rewarding with our praise and our dollars.
I was pleased to see you remark on Tom Davis's commentary on Tom Perriello. If you hadn't brought it up, I was going to bring it up. I thought it was the most distinctive remark that I can recall by one politician about another politician in a long, long time. And in fact, I have trouble thinking of any other current politicians making comments like that. It's like Tom Davis is almost unique. Maybe he is. That surprises me.
He's also retired.
I understand fully that his retirement allows him to say that, because if he tried to stand in Northern Virginia with his attitudes, the Tea Party would primary him.
Let's not go after the Tea Party as the sole cause of whatever we're talking about here.
Of course.
I think the Tea Party represents folks who want the system to work, and they want it to work well, and they're very frustrated because it isn't working well. And they're bringing that frustration into the process, as citizens should. I think the Tea Party has to and will grow up.
Yes, I understand. I just cited that because that's what has happened to a number of people similar to Tom Davis in the last election cycle. They got primaried, and they're not in the Congress, and they're out of politics. So he at least has the freedom to speak in a manner that otherwise would get him primaried. I'm surprised by He's almost unique, I think. And that remark that he made about Tom Perriello was the ultimate in civility, because he's an opponent politically and yet was acknowledging the virtue and value of his opponent. And that's something that you really need, is to actually respect the people that you're differing with.
You do, especially if you attempt to work with them and find some sort of agreement on basic policy.
Now, while I'd say that was the exemplar, or the ultimate exemplar of civility, a good example, perhaps the ultimate exemplar of incivility in our current politics, is remarks like Second Amendment remedies, threatening armed revolution.
Well, she lost. And that could be seen as instructive to the electorate as well. There are people who took the base too far one way or the other and were not rewarded by an electorate that was wanting something a little bit better than taking the base to an extreme. The Tea Party is growing up. The Tea Party will come up with better candidates. The Democratic Party is still growing up and will come up with better candidates. I think the tragedy of 2010, as I saw it in the 5th Congressional District, is I know Robert Hurt and I know Tom Perriello, and I know that neither one of them is anything like the way they were characterized. In fact, I had some very good conversations with Jeff Clark as well. I would say all three of them were poor caricatures of themselves in the media, very poor caricatures of themselves, because they are people who truly want the system to work and truly believe that it can, and at some point will be willing to talk to each other and cross over and engage in the kind of dialogue that has to be civil for it to be productive. So, you know, I think we are fortunate in the 5th Congressional District, A, to have the caliber of candidates we have, B, to have the caliber of election that we had, not in terms of the advertising, not in terms of the messaging, perhaps, as much as we had a real choice. And the district was engaged more than any other district. 55% of the active registered voters in the 5th came out and cast a vote, 43% statewide. That's 12% difference. We had a real choice. Many of those other districts did not have a real choice. There were only four districts that had a very real choice, and three of those went in the way of the way they hadn't been 2 years ago. So we're in a period of compressed pendulum swings.
Well, one major problem that I think is left over is the fact that we have 60% of our high school, of our children going to school, who do not graduate high school. So teaching civility, we don't even teach geography to students if candidates don't know where other states in the union are. And so what do we do about the numbers of children who go to school and don't graduate?
I would refer to Mayor Michael Bloomberg's remarks about the geographical knowledge of American congressional representatives. I think we have a serious problem that we're attempting to dumb down our educational system to certain basics, and that we have lost a great deal. We have lost the ability to have things that I think are very meaningful in our educational system, such as music, arts, geography, which I would have been my favorite subject in school, civility, and the understanding of our system as it was framed and as it has evolved. I mean, you know, American history is something fantastic, and we're blessed to be where we are, and we're cursed by that Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. We sure do. And, you know, it's our job to fix it. It's our job to stand up and say we demand a certain standard, and we are going to live by that standard, and we're going to try to convince you to live by that standard. And groups that are as engaged and as informed as this group have to be in the vanguard of that. So, you know, what I would do, were I a member of this group, is I would consider how to approach Congress and say, let's fix Citizens United. Let's come up with a way to take a broken political system that has multi-millions of dollars flowing in from God knows where, from God knows who, and say, let's have a little sunshine. Let's have a little disclosure. I mean, I think that will bring about more civility than any individual action that can be taken in the political context today, because I fear where we are going with unbridled, undisclosed contributions more than anything else. Thank you all very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.